You're listening to the Judicial Watch weekly update with Tom Fitton.
Hey everyone, Judicial Watch President Tom Fitton here with our weekly update on social media. Thank you as always for joining us. There is so much going on. We have new lawsuits. There have been major new developments in the various Trump trials, investigations, and prosecutions. New information from Judicial Watch about the CIA in January 6th that's going to knock your socks off. A new lawsuit or new lawsuits about Biden corruption. So much going on, and I want to talk about and give you a quick brief as well about our election integrity measures and how Judicial Watch continues to do the heavy lifting to ensure that voter rolls are cleaned throughout the nation. First up is the breaking news, or it was breaking earlier today, that Fannie Willis is allowed to stay on the case against Trump thanks to what essentially is a free pass given to her for misconduct by the judge, Judge McAfee. And this was my initial response to Judge McAfee's ruling. It will hopefully guide this, I think, this discussion. Let's put up that tweet. McAfee failed to uphold the rule of law today and effectively ratified outrageous and likely criminal misconduct by Fannie Willis and others associated with the sham prosecution of Trump. Nevertheless, Trump has largely been vindicated, as most normal Americans see through the judicial legerdemain, and have further confirmation of the political corrupted nature of the Get Trump election rigging scheme by Democratic Party politicians and their minions. So the judge essentially found, it looks like, he uses different language to describe it, that we can't believe anything that Fannie Willis and her boyfriend, Nathan Wade, said about their relationship. And he doesn't think there's enough specific conflicts of interest to warrant their disqualification or Fannie Willis's office's disqualification. He did think there was an appearance of impropriety in the least, the appearance of a conflict, and I'm not quite sure what the difference is as a practical matter, but that's what the judge ruled. And so he said, and let's go to the key part of that ruling. This was his key finding. There has not been a showing that the defendant's due process rights have been violated or that the issues involve prejudice to defendants in any way. Nor is disqualification of a constitutional officer necessary when a less drastic and sufficiently remedial option is available. The court therefore concludes that the prosecution of this case cannot proceed until the state selects one of two options. The district attorney may choose to step aside along with the whole of her office and refer the prosecutions to the prosecuting attorney's counsel, which is a state entity, for reassignment. Or alternatively, SADA, I guess Special Assistant District Attorney Wade, can withdraw, allowing the district attorney, the defendants, and the public to move forward without his presence or remuneration distracting from and potentially complicating the merits of the case. I think this is an absurd and outrageous ruling. I don't know how else to describe it. He essentially says that I can't believe the testimony and discredits the testimony in key respects by suggesting that there is at least the appearance of a conflict of interest, yet nonetheless believes that the public interest is served by allowing Fannie to proceed despite all the powerful evidence of her corruption. I don't buy it. And, you know, and in the beginning of the court's decision, which I think we'll link below, he highlights what the basic rules are for how our courts are supposed to protect the administration of justice. The administration of the law, and this is a decision from the Georgia courts. The administration of the law should be free of all temptation and suspicion, so far as human agency is capable of accomplishing that object. The administration of the law, and especially that of the criminal law, should, like Caesar's wife, be above suspicion and should be free from all temptation, bias, or prejudice. And later in the decision, the court found that despite all the evidence that you saw, and I don't want to belabor it, but it's pretty clear that they lied to the court about the nature of their relationship. Wade lied under oath, it looks like, about what his relationship was with Fannie Willis. They lied about when they started it. And the court just sloughs all of that off. Ultimately, dismissal of the indictment is not the appropriate remedy to adequately dissipate the financial cloud of impropriety and potential untruthfulness. And he said, well, I can't get into whether all the witnesses were specifically lying or not. It would just be too much work. I'm paraphrasing, but that's essentially what he says. So this was a political decision in the sense that he protected the Fulton County's prosecutors from what would be obviously for them the terrible removal of them from prosecuting Trump and others, if not in addition, to throw out the case in its entirety. Now, I don't know about you, but I believe that when you have a prosecutor messing around with her boyfriend in an adulterous relationship, if I recall, he was still married, there are questions about whether there was favoritism in his hiring. There are significant questions, and it doesn't have to be proven to a shadow of doubt. I guess the standard was preponderance of the evidence, which is, I always kind of see it as 50 plus one, right? Just a little bit more than a little over 50% of the evidence or certainty. That's my layman's analysis of it. That they were lying and that they were benefiting financially. I mean, he goes through, the court does, again, all this kind of throwing smoke up, saying, well, you know, they were splitting their costs of their trips together. Well, did he stop to think, does the court think that, well, maybe Nathan Wade wouldn't have been able to go on the trips at all if he didn't have the job? And he highlights the fact, well, he only gets $250 an hour. Lawyers all the time are happy to take a discounted rate if they're certain that there'll be a certain amount of work. You get essentially hired for the project. Obviously, you know, you can work hourly, but, you know, there isn't a lawyer, there are a few lawyers that wouldn't take a certain number of hours at a lesser rate versus hoping they get basically unknowable amounts of hours at a higher rate, you know, a bird in the hand. So the court just ignores all of that. And the court also ignores her outrageous statement at that black church, essentially accusing the defendants of racism for raising what we now know were well-founded questions about her ethics. It's what's called forensic misconduct. Now, the court yells at Fannie Willis about this. But, you know, all these reports or court opinions that criticize prosecutors or criticize government officials in the case of special counsels or IG reports that criticize people where there are no consequences to the criticism, forgive me for not being terribly impressed. I mean, here the court essentially confirms that Trump and the other defendants have been victimized by two people who were pushing a case. In a way that benefited them financially. I mean, the court says, well, you know, there was no evidence that they were trying to extend the case in order to extend, you know, the payments to Nathan Wade. Well, how about the idea that maybe the case would never have been filed or pursued if they didn't have the relationship? I mean, if someone commented on one of the social media platforms, you know, the court essentially found, he didn't come out and say they lied, but he said it in so many words. He didn't want to go there directly, but that's the inescapable conclusion from his order. We can't have two liars prosecuting, but we can have one liar. We can't trust these two to prosecute, but we can trust the one, despite all the evidence of misconduct and perjury. There should be a perjury investigation against Fannie Willis and Nathan Wade, among other criminal acts that they may have committed in this scheme against Trump. And it's further indication, as I say and said earlier, about how corrupt this targeting of Trump is. And I say you can't trust anything she says. This isn't the first time. Now we know from a Judicial Watch litigation that we just highlighted, or we just filed, that Fannie's office and maybe Fannie herself has been caught in a falsehood. We just filed a lawsuit for records that Fannie Willis has about communications with the January 6th committee and Jack Smith. And I talk about, you know, this key issue in this brief clip here.
Hey, everyone. Did Fannie Willis's office lie about records? Well, that's why Judicial Watch just sued Fannie Willis and Fulton County for records of communications they had with the January 6th committee and the Jack Smith operation being run by the Biden Justice Department. They told us, Fannie Willis's people did, that they had no records of communications with the January 6th committee or Jack Smith. But Congress just released a letter signed by Fannie Willis to the head of the January 6th committee. So what's up with that? Now, why did they give us what looks to be false information? Did they miss the record? Are there other records they're hiding? But all of this really highlights the corrupt, compromised, and politicized operations against Trump being run out of Fulton County that were run by the January 6th committee and that are currently being run also by Jack Smith and the Biden gang.
Sorry about that video. It looks like I got up in the middle of the night and recorded it, doesn't it? But I made the point that there's this new scandal that has caused Judicial Watch to pursue a state open records claim against Fannie Willis. We filed in Fulton County, Georgia, in the Superior Court, a new lawsuit under the Georgia Open Records Act. So it's not called FOIA. It's the Open Records Act in Georgia for the following records. A lawsuit for the following records. All documents and communications sent to, received from, or relating to Special Counsel Jack Smith or any employees in his office. All documents and communications sent to or received from the United States House January 6th Committee or any of its employees. Now, we had asked for these documents. When did we ask for them? Oh, we asked for them in August of 2023. So we asked for them back in August. And they came back, as I say in the clip, and they told us they didn't have any records, which suggests, right, strongly that there were no communications. Well, it turns out that evidently is not true in the sense that the House recently just released a letter that Fannie Willis had written to Benny Thompson, who was the then chair of the Pelosi Rump Committee, as I call it, that was investigating or pretending to investigate January 6th. It was all just a get Trump scheme. As we highlight in our lawsuit, Willis's and the county's representation about not having records responsive to the request is likely false. There was a December 5th, 2023 letter from House Judiciary Committee Chairman Jim Jordan to Willis that cites a December 2021 letter from Willis to then House January 6th Committee Chairman Benny Thompson. In that letter, Willis requested assistance from the committee and offered to travel to D.C. And Jim Jordan notes, specifically, you asked Thompson for access to records, including but not limited to recordings and transcripts of witness interviews and depositions, electronic and print records of communications and records of travel. You even offered that you and your staff were eager to travel to D.C. to meet with investigators in person and to receive these records anytime. in January and February of 2022. Willis's letter, as we say in the lawsuit, is plainly responsive to the request, yet it was neither produced in response to our request nor claimed to be subject to exemption. Now, just because we ask, and as the lawsuit points out, you know, you don't have to get, the law allows the agency that gets the request sometimes to withhold information. So what does that mean? They can claim an exemption, meaning it's confidential based on an exemption that we are follow, or you know, that is granted to us under law. There's a good reason under law for us to withhold the letter. But you typically have to tell the requester, well, we searched, we have certain records. Here are the ones that are releasable to you in whole or in part. Others, these are the reasons we're not giving them to you, because there are certain privileges or exemptions that apply. They told us they didn't have any records at all. Does that sound true to you? Do you think they missed it? I don't think they missed it. There were news reports and other records that we cite in the lawsuit which indicate that representatives of Willis's office traveled to D.C. and met with the January 6th committee in April, May, and November of 2022. So they followed up as she proposed. There were no communications setting up those meetings? Of course there were. And they should have been disclosed to us. And if they didn't want to turn them over to us, they should have said, we've got records, but we can't give them to you. So you have here a situation, because the lawsuit is against Fannie Willis and Fulton County, so we're named her directly. Both of them seem to have provided false information about having no records of communications with Jack Smith and the Pelosi January 6th committee. You know, and then of course there were other issues related to their communications with Jack Smith. And we already have a lawsuit over the hiring of Nathan Wade. Now he's no longer there. I guess it should be easy for them to give us all the records now, right? We'll see what happens there. But this is the sort of work that needs to be done. You know, the district attorney, a Democratic politician, who's, you know what, she's up for office again this year. I didn't realize that. She's running literally to stay in office as she's trying to prosecute Trump to what I would argue is a transparent attempt to keep him out of office. One candidate prosecuting another. Banana Republic stuff. So here we have a court essentially saying Fannie has a conflict of interest, or the appearance of a conflict of interest, gave her a pass on the actual conflict of interest in a way that I found completely unpersuasive and incomprehensible. And then we have other information that she lied to Judicial Watch or gave us false information, she and her people, about documents they had. Now, the interesting thing about FOIA in Georgia is that they have the law requires that you comply with FOIA. And if you don't comply with FOIA or the open records law in a good faith manner, you can be prosecuted. You can be charged with a crime. I think it's a misdemeanor. You can also face a civil fine. So it's going to be interesting to see how this turns out. Now, I don't know what's happening with the whole mess down there with Fannie Willis and her boyfriend, and how or if the Trump and other defendants are going to appeal the judge's ruling to let her continue to abuse Trump and others despite this evident corruption. So I don't know if they're going to continue that in terms of the appeal and what the timing of that will be. But the Fulton County issue is a mess. It was corrupt from the get-go. We had further evidence in addition to the political and abuse of power corruption targeting Trump because of his politics, not because he did anything wrong. we have now this underlying corruption in terms of just the petty personal corruption of Fannie Willis and Nathan Wade and who knows who else in the office of the attorney, the district attorney there in Fulton County. So this isn't over by a long shot, that's for sure. But there have been other developments as well. We had news this week that Alvin Bragg, over a year after he supposedly asked the Southern District of New York, which is the federal U.S. Attorney's Office up there under Biden, for documents, he said, well, I need more time. I need another 30 days before I try Trump on my charges against him because they just gave us 70,000. It depends on what timing it is. It's either 70 or 100,000, tens of thousands of pages of documents that they, quote, just got from the Southern District of New York, they decided to give to Trump. Documents he has a right to see under the law prior to his trial so he can prepare for trial because these documents were relevant to his case. And recall, the case is Trump paid they had a confidentiality agreement with Stormy Daniels. And as typical for confidentiality agreements, there's a consideration that Stormy Daniels benefited from, which was a payment now of, I forget what it was. Was it $130,000? $150,000? Well, it was what it was. So it was a payment. And so the Southern District of New York looked at it. The Federal Election Commission looked at it because the allegation was, oh, this should have been a campaign finance report. And of course, all of that would have been a misdemeanor under New York state law, mischaracterizing it on your books, you know, basically writing the wrong description in your checking account. Does that sound like worthy of pursuit? And I don't even think it was described incorrectly. They're just trying to screw around with Trump. But to make it a felony and to give them more time to prosecute, they said, well, it was designed to avoid federal campaign finance law. Well, he's a state prosecutor. He's a New York County prosecutor, Manhattan prosecutor. He's not supposed to be enforcing federal law. So it's a completely made-up case to try to punish Trump and abuse him as part of this scheme by Democratic politicians across America from here in the Washington, D.C., in the White House, his appointees, Biden's appointees in the Biden Justice Department, and then Fannie Willis, an elected politician, Democratic Party politician in Washington, D.C., who was coordinating with Nancy Pelosi's committee. And then on top of that, you got Alvin Bragg, the Soros-backed prosecutor up in New York, who was the first out of the gate to concoct a charge against Trump. It's like Putin and his Russian oligarchs going after an enemy of the state there. That's what's happening with Trump. There's no doubt about it. So that's the status of the Bragg case. I don't know when, if ever, it's going to go to trial at this point, given all, again, this prosecutorial misconduct targeting Trump. And then there's on top of that, there are big hearings. There's a lot going on in the Trump. I mean, maybe we just have to have a separate weekly update for all the Trump trials. What do you think? I don't know if I could handle that, but it seems like it's only going to accelerate because the left has an interest in trying to jail him before the election. That's why you have all this activity. So Judge Cannon had hearings this week, or a big hearing this week, on at least two of President Trump's several motions to dismiss the charges or restrict them. And Judge Cannon had heard two motions. One was that the Espionage Act, the Espionage Act, the language is unclear in such a way as to make it impossible for the prosecutors to fairly prosecute Trump. And she essentially said, not yet, maybe, but not yet. So she denied that motion without prejudice. But the other big motion she hasn't yet ruled on, and this is about the Presidential Records Act. And Judicial Watch is all over this motion and this debate because our case is the key case that, depending on how the judge rules, could either end the case or provide a key defense for the president if it indeed it goes to trial. And I want to give you an idea just how important the case is. And this is what Trump's team put up in their brief. I don't know if you can see that at the bottom. You bring that forward. Well, at least I can't see it at the bottom. Let me get my glasses on. Oh, you see it right here. The special counsel's office cannot escape Judicial Watch. It's italic, so they're referencing a case and history. So isn't that something else? And what is the Judicial Watch case? The Judicial Watch case is the Sockdrawer case, the Clinton-Sockdrawer case. And the Clinton-Sockdrawer case was a lawsuit that Judicial Watch had brought against the National Archives. And the National Archives, we believe, should have gone and gotten something we read about in the news. I think it was a Politico report that first uncovered that, you know, my glasses are distracting because I sat on my glasses, so if I just put them on normally, they seem like crooked, so I kind of, let's just take them off. So the Clinton-Sockdrawer case is this. So Clinton had recordations made by an author of his activities as president. The author was writing a book, he was recording Clinton, and Clinton was in the Oval Office and elsewhere in the White House making phone calls to politicians, members of Congress, and foreign leaders, at least one foreign leader. And those were captured on these audio tapes. And he didn't want them to come out for whatever reason, so he kept the audio tapes in his sock drawer. And we thought under the Presidential Records Act, aren't these the types of records that should have been turned over to the National Archives at the end of his presidency? And we sued to force the National Archives to go get the records. Well, the Justice Department said, no, you can't do that. The Archives said, no, you can't do that. And one of the biggest left-wing federal judges in the District of Columbia said, no, you can't do that. The Presidential Records Act doesn't give the authority to anyone to second-guess the president's decision to declare records personal or presidential. There's no enforcement. And plus, it's his discretion under the law and our Constitution. In fact, the lawyers for the Justice Department said specifically, because the issue was classified records, too. We thought there might be classified records among these tapes. Some of these tapes should have been classified. And so the lawyer goes up to court, and I'm paraphrasing, but I'm getting the gist of it right, and says in a key hearing, well, if he has them, they're presumptively personal. So when, I guess it was in 2022, we found out through press reports that the archives had harassed Trump about getting records back because they thought he didn't have a right to them, and Trump sent a bunch of boxes back. We're like, what is going on here? That they've changed their legal position? Because it was Trump. The Justice Department told us the exact opposite. No one had any business bothering a president after the fact, after he left office for records. And indeed, in the Hur report, he highlights that this has never been done before. Except for Trump, and they pretend that Trump did something different than anyone else did, which frankly isn't true. So that's the key issue before Judge Cannon. Whether this decision or the way it has been interpreted by the D.C. court here would preclude a prosecution by Jack Smith. And, you know, and that's one of the reasons that I was brought before the grand jury. Not because I had any real evidence as a witness. It's because they were trying to intimidate Judicial Watch and retaliate against Judicial Watch because we were behind this Clinton sock drawer case and highlighted the Justice Department hypocrisy and about face in changing the rules to go after Trump. So I don't know how Judge Cannon is going to rule on all this. You can, you know, all the briefs are online. If you're interested enough, you can go and find them. Now, she suggested that it might be defense at trial. It may not be enough to kind of throw out the case in the beginning. I disagree with her if that's her ultimate conclusion. But it highlights that the Clinton sock drawer case, despite everything you're hearing, and it's not because we agree with the outcome, it's we lost that case. And the Justice Department was on the other side. And now they switch sides because it's Trump. Let me then compare and contrast. That's the old essay. You know, remember you got your essays when you were learning in high school and college. You had assignments. Compare and contrast. I'm going to give you the assignment. Compare and contrast the treatment of Trump on presidential records with the treatment of Biden on presidential records. And to that end, you know, the Hur investigation came under scrutiny this week in Congress. Republicans had one approach. Democrats, as you might imagine, had another approach. Of course, just before the hearing came out, you know, they're going to have the special counsel who gave Biden a pass because he was mentally unfit. And there's a big debate about what was in the transcript. So we sued. And as I described here, this is the reason for the suit.
Hey, everyone. Judicial Watch President Tom Fitton here. We got a big new lawsuit. We just sued in federal court for the interview transcripts of Joe Biden's interviews with the special counsel. The Garland Justice Department is hiding the records from us, whether they be the written transcripts, audio, or video, I'm not sure. But either way, we want access to the records because we have a right to under FOIA law. Now, I know there's a big controversy about what went on in those interviews, and that's why Hur is testifying to Congress this week, and that's why we sued under FOIA just a few minutes ago. We have a right to know whether Joe Biden's memory is good or bad because it bears on his fitness for the presidency. So the fact Garland's hiding them, I think, speaks volumes about what the transcripts might show. But in the end, we have to get them. The Congress wants them. The American people have a right to them, and certainly we have a right to them under the law.
Well, we got them. They came out the day after we sued. They were leaked initially to friendly media and then released to Congress. Now, the question is, are the transcripts all that exist of the record of the meetings that Hur had with Biden? I think there were two interviews. Were there videos? Where's the video of the interviews? Was there audio of the interviews? I believe there are, and I want them. Judicial Watch wants them. So this ain't over, because the transcripts themselves show that Biden was, maybe his memory was poor. You know, he expressed outrage that the special counsel supposedly brought up his son's death, Beau's death. In fact, the transcript shows he brought it up. And the left has tried to pretend that Hur had no good faith basis to suggest that his memory was failing. The transcript shows that Biden's memory was a mess. And Hur fairly concluded that his memory was awful. Now, I think the decision not to prosecute him based on his appearance of a failing memory because the jury wouldn't buy it, I don't really buy that. I think it was just more, I'm not going to prosecute the president and I have to have a good reason for doing it. However devastating politically, it turned out for Biden. And of course, we can get further confirmation one way or another by looking at the videotape, right? Let's go to the videotape.
My team and I conducted a thorough, independent investigation. We identified evidence that the president willfully retained classified materials after the end of his vice presidency when he was a private citizen. This evidence included an audio recorded conversation during which Mr. Biden told his ghostwriter that he had, quote, just found all the classified stuff downstairs, end quote. When Mr. Biden said this, he was a private citizen speaking to his ghostwriter in his private rental home in Virginia.
Why wasn't he prosecuted? I mean, the new rules are that you can prosecute presidents no matter when. They're saying you can't prosecute a president when he's in office. Well, I don't know if I buy that, since if you can prosecute a president for official acts after he's in office, why can't you prosecute a president when he's in office, especially for, it looks like in this case, a crime that took place when he wasn't in office at all? I'm not persuaded by her, given the gravity of what her describes. I mean, look at this other comment by her.
My task was to determine whether the president retained or disclosed national defense information willfully. That means knowingly and with the intent to do something the law forbids. I could not make that determination without assessing the president's state of mind. For that reason, I had to consider the president's memory and overall mental state and how a jury likely would perceive his memory and mental state in a criminal trial. These are the types of issues that prosecutors analyze every day. And because these issues were important to my ultimate decision, I had to include a discussion of them in my report to the Attorney General. The evidence and the president himself put his memory squarely at issue. We interviewed the president and asked him about his recorded statement. Quote, I just found all the classified stuff downstairs, end quote. He told us that he didn't remember saying that to his ghostwriter. He also said he didn't remember finding any classified material in his home after his vice presidency. And he didn't remember anything about how classified documents about Afghanistan made their way into his garage. My assessment in the report about the relevance of the president's memory was necessary and accurate and fair. Most importantly, what I wrote is what I believe the evidence shows and what I expect jurors would perceive and believe. I did not sanitize my explanation, nor did I disparage the president unfairly.
Well, you can see I've been playing around with the new Instagram function of just watching stuff that gets me upset. In that case, I was making a cup of coffee. But how ridiculous an argument is that? Well, you know, I guess maybe it's not ridiculous from his perspective, to be fair. But how can Garland accept that analysis? Because he's accepted the report. And if he thinks President Biden is sufficiently with it to be prosecuted, and that he's wrong, that his memory is failing, and there's evidence of it that will come across to a jury, then Garland should overrule her's recommendation and prosecute Biden. Because as the previous clip show, her concluded there were violations of law, strong evidence of violations of law, warranting prosecution. And lies. Let's go to Matt Gaetz's questioning.
February 8th, the White House. Question, Mr. President, why did you share classified information with your ghostwriter? The president. I did not share classified information. I did not share it. I guarantee I did not. That's not true, is it, Mr. Herr?
That is inconsistent with the findings based on the evidence in my report.
Yeah, so it's a lie, is just what regular people would say, right? Yeah, all right. So the next one. And all the stuff that was in my home was in filing cabinets that were either locked or able to be locked. That wasn't true either, was it?
That was inconsistent with the findings of our investigation.
Another lie, people might say, right? Because what you put in your report was, among the places Mr. Biden's lawyers found classified documents in the garage was a damaged open box.
So Biden lies and Trump is the one who gets prosecuted. I mean, that's what the special counsel said. Because what Trump did, it was worse. Trump has been held to a different standard. Well, maybe it's the same standard. I often joke, I say, you know, everyone complains about the double standards, right? And that the left has. There's one standard for Democrats, one standard for Republicans, one standard for friends of the deep state, one standard for its enemies. And I would say it's probably just one standard, and it's the Obama standard. Protect your friends and punish your enemies. So that's the standard. It's a single standard. Protect your friends and punish your enemies. That's how this Justice Department is run, and her testimony confirms it. So we've got a lawsuit about her, H-U-R, the transcripts and such, and you can bet more is coming. You know, recall, we sued in Delaware for access to Biden Senate records. We sued and were up and down. I think we went to the Supreme Court of Delaware twice, and the University of Delaware successfully stonewalled the release of this information because there were Senate records that could reflect on not only his presidency, and the public had an interest in getting, but as we now know, he committed crimes. There's evidence of crimes in those records with the Senate, the classified information from his Senate records. And it was Judicial Watch, it was alone in fighting for that. So we just sued. We had asked for the records back in February of the transcripts. So I don't know if there are any videos. I think there are. But the Biden Justice Department needs to follow the law and get us the records ASAP. I'm sure you agree. So maybe I'm saving the biggest story for last. Is this the biggest story? Well, actually, before I get to that story, I want to cover something else. We were just... I don't know where you watched this weekly update. We're on X, known as Twitter. We're on Rumble. We're on True Social. We're on Facebook. We're on Instagram. We're on YouTube. Am I missing any other social media platforms?
That's it.
Yeah, I think we covered it all. But YouTube, massive numbers of people on YouTube. And we're not going to be cowed and pushed off YouTube by the left. So we post what we're able to post there. And sometimes we get into battles with YouTube, which is owned by Google or Alphabet now, right? Because they delete and vandalize our posts. And by vandalize, I mean they label. I don't know if you guys can pull it up while I'm talking. When we talk about, well, January 6th, I'm going to talk about it later, so I don't want to. They're probably going to label it anyway. They have like a label saying, oh, for January 6th material, go for the truth about January 6th or more context, go to the Wikipedia entry on January 6th. I mean, they might as well say just go to Nancy Pelosi's website for discussion on January 6th. And of course, that's designed to undermine the credibility of the content under which the labeling occurs. But that's like typical YouTube. And of course, they've deleted material outright on behalf of the left and to advance and there it is. Isn't that outrageous? And that's typical. And they've deleted videos. We have a federal lawsuit that's ongoing where the California Secretary of State convinced YouTube to take down a video of Judicial Watch's. It was our one of our weekly updates just before the 2020 election, expressing our First Amendment rights and our expert opinion on mail-in ballots and other election controversies. They just took the video down. And there have been other circumstances that there's so many I can't list. But the most recent purge, I call it the Great Purge, they took down 17 videos, 15, 16, 17? I think it was 17. Of Judicial Watch, where either me or my colleague Chris Farrell, Judicial Watch essentially, appeared on other channels that were, or programs that had been banned from YouTube, namely Dan Bongino. Look at this, The Great Purge. YouTube just took down this and 15 others, so it was 16 videos of appearances on Dan Bongino, Seb Gorka, and Simon, and Steve Bannon's War Room. And this is the sort of information they took down. So the Bongino clip was where I talked about how the Fauci agency, can we bring this up closer? I don't know if people can read it. The Fauci agency had provided Wuhan bat coronavirus funding, It was under FBI investigation. Oh, yeah, that's what we found. Now I'm reading the, I'm being reminded as I read the tweet and the description of the interview. Judicial Watch found that early on in COVID, the FBI had initiated an investigation into the Wuhan coronavirus funding by the Fauci agencies. So it was a great interview with Dan Bongino, who's a great guy, loves Judicial Watch, great patriot, but he's been banned from YouTube for the obvious reasons. Same goes for Bannon and Seb Gorka. Isn't that outrageous? So if you want to see the videos they took down, you can go to our Rumble page where we reposted them or highlighted them specifically. But this is what we have to fight every day at Judicial Watch. Now, YouTube has eased up on some of its censorship in the last few months. I mean, it used to be that if I raised questions about the 2020 election and whether fraud had a material impact, that was their rule, you couldn't, they'd take your video down. Unbelievable. Now they've stopped doing that. And they used to take, I don't know if it's YouTube, but it doesn't matter. It's all these social media companies, you know, they were taking down content based on leftist demands. And in this case, they went back in some cases and took down videos from years ago. That's how petty what I call this communist censorship program is that YouTube is running. So if you're if you don't think you're getting the full truth on YouTube, you can go to our site directly at judicialwatch.org. You can go to Rumble. Twitter, you know, under Elon Musk, obviously has freer speech. But it's always going to be a challenge. And this is why I say on the internet, I never know that we're still going to have a free internet. Even because they want to destroy Musk. So who knows how long Twitter will last, or X, as it's now called. And that's why if you want access to Judicial Watch information, the best way to do that is to send a snail mail. Use the U.S. Postal Service, and I know who knows if that will be allowed to be used by conservatives as the communist revolution continues. But communicate, you know, send us your phone number, send us your address, donate to us directly, but make sure we have your name on file so we can communicate directly with you about the work we do. Because the internet is wonderful. The left hates it because it is so wonderful in terms of allowing people who otherwise would never be able to gain access to information. I mean, you could see, just watching this video or any of our Judicial Watch videos or the material we post directly online in these social media platforms, why the left hates us so much. And when it comes to our election work, we don't, you know, they can censor us, but it doesn't stop us from doing the work necessary to protect freer and fairer elections and cleaner elections. And I talked about that last week, and I want to reemphasize this case that we just filed because it's so important. It's in such a big state because Illinois hasn't been cleaning up its election rolls. Many of its counties haven't been as they're supposed to. And there's this massive problem with dead voters in Illinois.
Hey, everyone, we got a big problem. There are still too many dead voters on the voting rolls. In Illinois, Judicial Watch just uncovered that 19 counties haven't removed dead people from the rolls in several years. And that's one of the reasons why Judicial Watch just filed a big lawsuit against Illinois to make sure that state does the basic work to remove people from the rolls who shouldn't be there, especially dead people.
Dead people on the rolls in Illinois. Now they could be removing some, but they're not reporting them as they're supposed to. But this is why the lawsuit was filed. And the Justice Department isn't doing this work, even though they're supposed to be enforcing the law. And Judicial Watch has a significant record of cleaning up voting rolls. Well, it's actually an unparalleled record of cleaning up voting rolls. 4 million in the last few years. California, 1.2 million names cleaned up. New York City, 440,000. Washington, D.C., 138,000. North Carolina, I forget the number, but it's significant. We're, you know, when you get up to 4 million, there's a lot of names that go into that. Pennsylvania, thousands and tens of thousands of names being cleaned up. But Illinois is still a mess, and so we have filed this important federal lawsuit. And thankfully, there are others who are doing it as well. Our friends at the Public Interest Legal Foundation have also been doing work. Even the RNC filed a new lawsuit just last week against the state of Michigan, because they make the allegation there that the counties in Michigan and those responsible in Michigan aren't cleaning up the rolls as they're supposed to, that you have many jurisdictions that have more people on the rolls than there are living there and eligible to vote, which is a key metric you look at to make sure they're cleaning up the rolls. If you got more people on the rolls than are actually living there, that's a pretty good indication you're not doing what you're supposed to do under federal law. Don't you agree? That's one of the issues in the Illinois case that we just filed. So there's a lot more to be done. More litigation could be coming. I think it is coming by Judicial Watch. So I wanted to remind you about that, because this is a major issue. Because so many of these states mail out ballots. Now, some of these folks who are aged out or not supposed to, who shouldn't be on the rolls at all, sometimes they don't get ballots if they haven't been active for long enough. But they're still able to vote. But it's an indication that, quote, active people haven't been removed as well, and they're getting ballots that they shouldn't be getting. A big deal. But it's some of our most important work, and I encourage you to go on Judicial Watch's website and find out about our election integrity work, because no one is doing as much, certainly in the nonprofit sector, as Judicial Watch is, to ensure fair and clean elections. Simply no one is doing as much. Now, I got a question for you. What if I had told you 3 weeks ago, and I said, oh, I think the CIA was involved somehow on January 6th. Somehow they were involved somehow. I'd probably get thrown off the internet, right, for promoting a conspiracy theory. But we just uncovered documents that show the CIA had folks involved in the response to January 6th. And here's my video first highlighting it.
Hey, everyone. Judicial Watch President Tom Fitton here with some massive news. Judicial Watch just uncovered that the CIA was involved in the response to the January 6th disturbances on Capitol Hill. In fact, CIA bomb technicians were sent over to the RNC and DNC where those pipe bombs supposedly were found. On top of that, there were CIA dog teams on standby in response to January 6th. Now, there are a lot of questions that are raised by our disclosures. First of all, why did it take Judicial Watch heavy lifting in federal court to get access to these documents after all these years? Why didn't the Pelosi January 6th committee, even as corrupt as it was, not disclose the CIA involvement? What was the CIA involved for? Were they investigating foreign intelligence operations? Were they investigating American citizens? What else have they done related to January 6th? All these questions you can be sure your Judicial Watch will pursue in federal court if necessary.
That's a pretty good summary, huh? Isn't it incredible? So we had asked for records from the Department of Justice. What did we ask for? Last year. We asked for records and communications regarding shots being fired inside the U.S. Capitol, as well as requests for Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms Explosive Special Response Team assistance on January 6th. So remember, they had these pipe bombs that were supposedly found at the RNC and DNC. And so we were interested in the responses there. So we got a bunch of text messages. Of course, they ignored our request, and we had to sue in federal court. Again, this is June of 2023. We filed the lawsuit. We probably had asked. Yeah, we asked in um, No, we filed the lawsuit in August. We asked for the records in June. So we've been waiting almost a year for these records. And it took a federal lawsuit to get them out to us. And so we got these ATF text messages that detail the CIA's involvement. And there are kind of two sets of text messages. And they're very interesting to read because they do talk about, as I say, we were asking about the reports of shots fired. The only shots were fired were the shots fired, at least in the Capitol, the shot fired at poor Ashley Babbitt by Lieutenant Michael Byrd, U.S. Capitol Police officer, who, in our view, unlawfully shot her, illicitly shot her for no good reason, popped out, shot her, dead. And we're representing her family in a wrongful death action right now, a federal lawsuit against the U.S. government for $30 million. So here you can see the ATF, you know, basically all these panic text messages about the disturbance on January 6th. But what was most interesting in them to me was the involvement of the Secret Service. So here's the first text message detailing the involvement of the Central Intelligence Agency, not the Secret Service, the CIA. Several CIA dog teams on standby near the southwest area of the Capitol. What were they doing there? Why were they on standby? Were they called ahead of time? I don't know. First time we're hearing about it. And then there were technicians sent to where those pipe bombs were. CIA bomb techs. Why were they down there? You know, now typically the CIA is not supposed to be involved in domestic operations like that. So what was the purpose of their being involved? I mean, this is the D.C. area. We don't need extra folks like the CIA being involved here typically. Was there a foreign intelligence component that they were investigating? What else did they do? I don't know. But we're going to ask more questions and try to find out. But these are pretty extraordinary records, don't you agree? The CIA was involved in the response to January 6th. Were they called ahead of time and told to stand by? Who talked to them? Why were they put on standby? Or did they just show up in an emergency fashion on January 6th? I don't know. Why didn't Pelosi's rump January 6th committee disclose this? Where's the media been? Where have Republicans been? Do you think it's important that CIA resources were deployed in response to the January 6th? And I don't even know if it was in response. Maybe they were just waiting around because they knew something was going to happen. I had a good interview. We should link the interview below with Glenn Beck about this. But this is pretty shocking. CIA do anything else related to January 6th? Then we're going to ask the question other than Judicial Watch? I hope so. Maybe Congress can finally do something after they spend all of our money. I thought this was going to be a calm, cool, and collected weekly update, but I guess not. I'm a little bit heated. There's a lot of injustice going on, a lot of outrageous conduct. Our republic is under attack. We have a border invasion just continues to undermine our sovereignty and result in carnage across the country. Tough days. But what I love about Judicial Watch is that at least there's, you know, there are certain things we can do about it. One of those things is to sue in federal court or sue in courts, represent people who are harmed, to try to vindicate the rule of law, restore the rule of law, and hold the government accountable. And we can only do it with your support. I mean, if you think this type of work I'm talking about here, uncovering the CIA being involved in the response to January 6th, suing Fannie Willis after we found out she gave us false information, it looks like, about her communications. Suing for Biden corruption documents. Trying to defend our fair and clean, well, trying to make sure our elections are fair, free and clean by ensuring our voting rolls are cleaned up. If you think all that's important, I encourage you, join our cause, join our movement, support Judicial Watch. Go to judicialwatch.org, make a donation, and of course, pray for our great country and pray for my colleagues and I at Judicial Watch who are trying to defend it. And with that, I will say, I want to wish you a happy St. Patrick's Day. All my fellow Irishmen, happy St. Patrick's Day. But see you next week here on The Update.
Thanks for listening to the Judicial Watch Weekly Update with Tom Fitton. For more information, visit www.judicialwatch.org, because no one is above the law.